So in addition to being the speaker, since I'm an organizer, I have to make a lot of announcements. The first announcement is the geometry program is planning a would like to plan a picnic for Thursday afternoon and evening, but the organizers don't want to actually have to plan it. So we've reserved Goleta Beach, and we'd like a volunteer committee to emerge from the audience to work on organizing the picnic.
So you really have to the day fiesta begins downtown Santa Barbara.
Well, that will mean fewer people at Goleta Beach competing with us for space.
I mean, there's a big picnic associated with that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
So you're not volunteering. So please see Dan if you're going to volunteer. No, please don't see Dan.
Please emerge.
Second announcement is that we will not have a discussion session this afternoon, but we'll plan to have one tomorrow, but we still need to have more questions formulated in advance for our discussion session so that it's a little more organized than the one was last week. And so please either emailing is difficult right now because the computers are not working, but that they're supposed to be working this afternoon, hopefully. And so either email suggestions, questions for the discussion session to me, or put them in Dan Fried's box in the mailroom. And I guess, we can continue with K-theory discussions as we were doing last week, or we can have discussions about supergravity or potentially about algebraic geometry if questions arise from the lectures that I'm giving. More announcements? No. Thanks. So what did I call this? Essential algebraic geometry. So after spending a few minutes describing how it is that algebraic geometry gets into this subject at all, I'm going to give some very basic, I'm going to review some very basic features of algebraic geometry in an effort to explain, particularly to the physicists in the audience, some of the points which all physicists by now, all string theorists by now ought to have heard about, but in many cases, these what I think are the essential points are not always emphasized. So I should say right off the top of the bat that anybody who thinks of themselves as an algebraic geometer should not stay very long in these lectures. And not only will I not be offended if you leave, I'll be astonished if you stay. Second thing I'd like to say is that please stop me and ask questions, because I really want to make sure that I'm going at a pace that can be absorbed by everybody. So, as we've just been hearing, when we study string theory in low-energy approximation, or M-theory, we end up getting interested in certain backgrounds for gravity and supergravity theories. And I'm going to be interested in a class of backgrounds which look like a compact space of dimension d, and then a Minkowski space of dimension 1, k minus 1. And whether d plus k is 10 or 11 depends on whether we're doing M-theory or one of the string theories. And the condition that the effective theory in k space-time dimensions retains some supersymmetry is the existence of covariantly constant spinners. I'm assuming a metric product here. So we want covariantly constant spinners, on xd. So it's a little bit different from the PP wave discussion at the end of Gary Gibbons' lecture. I really do want to split things as a product, and so I'll consider the decomposition of a spinner from the large 10 or 11 dimensional space into these two different pieces according to the decomposition, the product decomposition of this manifold, and look at the projection onto the XD part. So we would like, for considering such backgrounds, to study Riemannian metrics which have covariantly constant spinners. Now, having the existence, I should say, of a covariantly constant spinner restricts the holonomy of a Riemannian manifold. And in fact, there's a theorem of essentially due to Berger with further refinements by other people over the years, which classifies possible holonomies of Riemannian manifolds. So my kind of working assumption in these lectures is that the audience knows more about differential geometry than about algebraic geometry. So I can define things like holonomy if you like, but I sort of assume people know a little bit about that. So the holonomy classification, the Berger, or sometimes Berger-Simons classification of holonomy, it's really a classification of the holonomy group. So how did that group arise? I sat at a point and looked at all loops or all contractible loops, depending on whether you're doing strict holonomy or full holonomy, on the manifold. I did parallel transport around the loop, and I followed the tangent space around as I did parallel transport, and what I got was some rotation of the tangent space when I came back, so some element of SON. So people often loosely refer to the holonomy group, but in fact, it's a holonomy representation. There's a group together with a specific representation. And the holonomies, the holonomy representations with covariantly constant spinner are a fairly simple list. There's the trivial representation, which corresponds to flat metrics. I should say, there's a theorem which says that the holonomy representation is completely reducible. So there's a notion of irreducible holonomy representations, and I'm going to write down the irreducible ones. And then you can form other ones by taking products. So I can get flat spaces of arbitrary dimension by taking a product of a bunch of copies of R1. There's SUN on R2N, the standard representation of SUN, where I take N to be at least 3, and that's called a Calabi-Yau metric. There's SPN on R4N, again, the standard representation. That's called a Hyper-Kähler metric. Then there are the seven-dimensional representation of the compact group G2, eight-dimensional representation of the group spin 7, which don't have names other than G2 and spin 7 holonomy. So the list of all holonomies is longer, but these are the ones that have covariantly constant spinners. So they're the ones that arise in this naive compactification of supergravity theories as products of a compact space and a Minkowski space. Now, there's a remarkable theorem, which is what gives us a translation into algebraic geometry, which applies to these two cases. So I should tell you a little bit about these structures, I guess. Quaternionic Kähler doesn't have a covariantly constant spinner. So the ones I left out were generic Riemannian metric. I can make a list of those if you like. So no covariantly constant spinner. So there's SON on RN, that's generic Riemannian metric. There's UN on R2N, which is Kähler. There's SP1 times SPN mod Z2 on R4N, which is so-called quaternion Kähler. And there's H somewhere for locally symmetric metrics G mod H. So there's a whole list of exceptions which come from locally symmetric spaces. So I want to tell you a little bit more, and I should say that that hopefully Robert Bryant will tell you something about the G2 and spin 7 cases in his lectures. He may say more about the whole holonomy picture. But let me tell you about the structures that underlie the Calabi-Yau and Hyper-Kähler cases. So I'm using There's a lot of ambiguity in the literature, I should say, about the use of the term collabial, and I'm using it for the present purpose to mean a metric which has irreducible holonomy that's precisely SUN with n at least 3. But sometimes collabial is used to indicate this entire class, including, well, maybe also including flat and including products of the above and so on. But in this more restrictive sense of collabial, what collabial means is that there exists, well, first of all, a complex structure on the manifold. There exists a holomorphic n-form. So it's a complex structure of complex dimension n. So that means something which locally looks like f of z1 up to zn dz1 wedge up to dzn in complex coordinates, local complex coordinates. And which is nowhere vanishing. So f has no zeros whatsoever. And what else do I want to say? So this is data that we have, and then the metric is Ricci flat. And if I call this holomorphic form capital Omega, there's some equation like the determinant. I'm sorry, I don't have this in my notes. I should have written it down. The determinant of omega omega bar, dd bar is 0. That doesn't quite look sensible the way I've written it down. But some equation roughly like that is the geometric translation of Ricci flat. So the additional piece of data, in addition to the complex structure, and this holomorphic n form is the Kähler form. So Riemannian metric, in fact, the metric is Kähler. That's one of its properties. And a Riemannian metric, which is Kähler, can be has a natural two form that's built out of the curvature, which looks like up to factors of I and 2, which I may have gotten wrong. The components of the I don't know why that's called G there. It should be omega. Certain components of the curvature can be written out as an antisymmetric form, which is another invariant of this metric. So this two form, this complex n form, are both covariantly constant, as well as the covariantly constant spinner that I mentioned. Those generate the covariantly constant spinners and tensors, which determine this holonomy. In the hyperkähler case, there exists a unique complex structure up to complex conjugation, which is compatible with this metric and leaves you with a Kähler metric. Here there exists an S2 worth of complex structures, which are compatible with this metric in the sense that the metric becomes Kähler. And with respect to one of them, if we choose one, then we have the Kähler form, omega 1, which is the Kähler form. And we also have a covariantly constant holomorphic 2 form, which I can write in real and imaginary parts, omega 2 plus I omega 3. So that's the covariantly constant holomorphic 2 form, which is, again, nowhere vanishing. And the invariant is really the span of these three, omega 1, omega 2, omega 3. That subspace in, say, the second Durham cohomology is the natural invariant in this case. And you can form a capital omega by taking this 2 form and raising it to the n over 2 power, wedging it with itself n over 2 times, in other words, to get a structure that formally looks like this one with a Kähler form and a holomorphic n form. So in that sense, these two cases can be discussed together for many purposes. So Kalabi conjectured and Yao proved that if you're given the complex structure and the Kähler form in these two cases, so in this Calabi-Yau case or hyper-Kähler case, you have to make an assumption, which is that the canonical bundle of the manifold is zero. That's the same thing as saying that there exists a nowhere vanishing holomorphic N form, and I'll discuss statements like that in more detail a little bit later. Then there exists a unique Ricci flat metric in the same Kähler class as the original. So Calabi proved the uniqueness and conjectured the existence, which was then proved about 20 years later by Yau. Well, I will duck that question by saying that up here I was working with irreducible holonomy, and I probably should have even restricted myself to simply connected spaces. And then one should quote a theorem about how if you have a more arbitrary manifold with a compact manifold with covariantly constant spinner, there's going to be a finite cover which splits as a product of a torus and a bunch of irreducible holonomy guys. And so you then have to analyze kind of separately the case of simply connected irreducible holonomy guys and finite group actions on them. So that's ducking the question.
You're not saying
There is a Ricci flat metric still. No, it's certainly invariant. But the uniqueness makes it. So long as you choose the Kähler class to be invariant, then it's invariant. So an Enriquez surface has a Ricci flat metric, if that's right. Right. Well, I as I said, I should have put it in my notes and. Pardon? Log. Yes, thank you. Robert, please help me.
All it means is that when we reach flat, comes down to saying that omega bar has constant size. I mean, in the non-compact case...
I should divide by the volume form or something.
That, in general, don't assume omegas... Right. I mean, it's really the volume of the metric that he's worried about whether or not the volume of the metric is. That can take log out of the
UR. Right. So I shouldn't have said determinant there. I should have said something like this. I should have said something like... Omega bar divided by omega to the n. Well, that doesn't matter since I'm taking setting something equal to zero afterwards.
Well, you have to take log or something.
Yeah.
And log,
okay, fine. I to the n or something like that, maybe? Something like that. So what makes the link to algebraic geometry from this setup is the fact that in this Calabi-Yau case, in the sense that I'm using it, X Calabi-Yau actually implies that X as a complex manifold can be embedded in complex projective space, CPN, or which I'll just probably call PN for short. And if X is hyperkähler, that implies that for some choice of compatible complex structure with the metric being fixed, X, again as a complex manifold, forgetting the metric structure, can be embedded in projective space. And actually, this statement is generic moduli only. I have to be a little careful about that. So, equipped with these facts, one can reduce the problem of studying such backgrounds to the following. You look around in complex projective spaces for manifolds that have this property of kx equals 0, in other words, the existence of a nowhere vanishing holomorphic n-form for an n-dimensional manifold. You try to learn what the set of all possible Kähler classes are on that manifold, and then for each Kähler class, you know that there's a unique Ricci flat metric associated to that class. So one's trying to study the possible complex structures on the manifold. In other words, there's an even further reduction of structure you can make by forgetting about the complex structure and just thinking of it as a topological or a smooth manifold. And one can look at what are all the possible complex structures you could put on it, together with the possible Kähler forms, and that will classify the set of Ricci flat metrics. Up to doing a little bit of careful analysis in the hyper-Kähler case to understand what happens as you're varying the complex structure. So there's a funny thing about having to choose a complex structure to get it into projective space, and that story becomes a little bit more complicated. So I'm going to try to ignore that complication for the most part and focus on this Calabi-Yau case where I don't have to think about it too much. Now, in passing, I should point out that there are some other pieces of data which you might have needed to specify the background. So the background, the supergravity background, which we want to use for string theory or M-theory purposes, might also require, well, for example, in the type 1 or heterotic string, you might require, it could include a flat G-bundle, where the cases that are most often considered are G equals spin 32 mod Z2, or G equals EA cross EA. It probably also includes in most of these theories, a so-called D field, a two-form field. And so that would be specified by, by an abelian gerb with gerb connection, flat gerb connection, if you want to use that language. And then you might also have to specify other p-form fields, these Ramon-Ramon fields, which again would be given by abelian, say, k-gerbs in one possible mathematical interpretation. So this non-abelian gauge theory also has a nice translation into algebraic geometry. The specification of abelian p-form fields turns into a, well, there's an associated cohomology class. We heard a discussion last week about how Deligne cohomology is probably a good mathematical setting for describing such fields. And that looks like a collection of auxiliary parameters which are not going to affect the geometry too much. You can read off what the possible set of choices are by making a cohomological computation, and you don't need to do too much geometry. It's pretty much all topology. The case of a flat G-bundle is a little bit different. So in the case of a flat G-bundle, well, initially for vector bundles, and one can somehow extract statements about principal G-bundles from the original statements. There's the theorem of Donaldson, Uhlenbeck, and Yau, which makes a dictionary between flat connections. Pardon? G-bundles with a flat connection? I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't mean flat G bundles exactly. I mean G bundles with a Hermitian Yang-Mills connection. And the Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau theorem tells us that Hermitian Yang-Mills connections correspond to holomorphic structures in this Calabi-Yau case. So again, this additional piece of the data can be encoded into algebraic geometry and can be studied in the language of algebraic geometry.
Do we need to define
what a gerb
is? Pardon?
No. If you're a physicist, you already know a gerb. It's a two-form field. And if you're a mathematician, a gerb is a fancy word for talking about actions and Lagrangians with two-form fields. Well, it could be other things, too. There are other interpretations of gerb. That's correct. I'm looking at a restricted class of backgrounds where these various things have decoupled. And you're right that one should also study more general backgrounds where there's some terms that could link them together. Okay, and the last sort of warm-up information is one is also interested in recent years in what are sometimes called supersymmetric cycles, which will determine BPS states in these theories in many contexts. And these supersymmetric cycles correspond to, in some generality, correspond to calibrated submanifolds of the manifold with special holonomy that we're looking at. And this is, again, the subject of Robert Bryant's lectures later in the week, so I won't say too much about it. But the one case where the problem of studying calibrated submanifolds translates into algebraic geometry is, so this is one case of this construction, is complex submanifolds equipped with some kind of flat bundle of Calabi-Yau manifolds. And again, using Donaldson-Uhlenbeck-Yau, this turns into holomorphic data, complex submanifold together with some holomorphic bundle supported on the submanifold. And one can try to describe it in terms of algebraic geometry. Yes, thanks. So an algebraic geometer starts with some subvariety of complex projective space. And complex projective space is itself described in terms of homogeneous coordinates normally. So I take Cn plus 1 minus the origin, and I mod out by C star. And in terms of what are known as holomorphic coordinates, I might use coordinates z0 up to zn. The C star action takes this, the action by lambda takes this to lambda z0, lambda z1, up to lambda zn. And this allows you to write, so we use square brackets instead of round brackets to denote the coordinates, just so that we are keeping in mind the fact that this is a homogeneous coordinate. And it allows you, for example, to write everything in terms of n out of these n plus 1 coordinates if you know that a particular one of them is non-zero. So, for example, this is the same as 1, z1 over z0 up to zn over z0 if z0 is not 0. The set of all those would correspond to cn, and so cpn forms a natural compactification of cn, including some points which, from the perspective of cn, appear to be out at infinity. But it's not the sort of one-point compactification that that Graham was using last week for topological purposes. Sitting at infinity, if you take pn minus cn, is a copy of pn minus 1. So the amount that you're adding at infinity is substantially larger. Now, given a subvariety, a submanifold of projective space, and a choice of homogeneous coordinates on that projective space, there are some natural subsets of X. So di will be the intersection of X with the vanishing of the ith coordinate. This is a complex submanifold of X of codimension 1, assuming X does not lie in a linear subspace of Pn. So you could always put one projective space into a larger projective space and look at subvarieties of the smaller one, and then that statement wouldn't quite be true. But I'll get codimension 1 submanifolds of a given manifold X every time I've assumed at the outset that X completely fills out the projective space that we put it in the sense of linear span. Ratios of homogeneous coordinates are well-defined objects, even though the homogeneous coordinates themselves are not well-defined. So these, we use the term coordinate, but it's a little misleading because it's not an honest coordinate on the space. It's only defined up to this ambiguity of multiplication by non-zero lambda. But this is a well-defined meromorphic function. So meromorphic means it has zeros and it's allowed to have poles on complex projective space, and by restriction to X we get a meromorphic function on X. And a natural thing which you may have learned in studying Riemann surfaces in complex analysis to do with a meromorphic function is to consider its divisor. That means the set where the function is 0 minus the set where the function has a pole, so the value of the function is infinite. And in this case, that divisor, so it's a formal linear combination of submanifolds with possible integer coefficients, and it looks like di, this complex submanifold, minus dj. Sorry, I call it a submanifold. Of course, it's only a submanifold if the coordinates were chosen appropriately so that these are transverse intersections. If you choose the coordinates in a non-generic way, there may be tangencies, and you have to worry a little bit about tangencies and so on. But to first approximation, this is a submanifold, and we can take linear combinations of submanifolds. So there's an entire theory of divisors on complex manifolds, which is designed to sort of abstract from this basic case of differences between hyperplane sections with respect to a specific projective embedding. Now, the reason that such a lot of attention has been paid to that particular aspect of the theory is that we would like to construct algebraic geometry as an intrinsic theory. So there's this tension in formulations of geometry that's existed for hundreds of years between intrinsic and extrinsic points of view. In an intrinsic point of view, you'd like to formulate things without reference to some external space. So properties like curvature, Riemannian curvature, are examples of intrinsic properties, geometric structures, whereas extrinsic properties will involve the embedding into some larger manifold, into some larger space. So in algebraic geometry, we tend to be handed things in extrinsic form, and there's no metric involved initially in algebraic geometry. I mean, the natural objects of study are just these submanifolds of projective space in which you're keeping track of the complex structure, but you've sort of forgotten, well, if you're a string theorist, you've forgotten that there's a metric. I mean, if you're an algebraic geometer, there never was a metric to begin with. And the goal is to find formulations which have more to do with X than with Pn. So to learn properties of X, we actually are forced to study them in the context of embeddings into projective space, usually, but we like to find intrinsic properties of X which don't depend on the embedding in some way. So to the natural abstraction of the data that is specifying the embedding is encoded in this notion of divisors. So more generally, a divisor is some linear combination with integer coefficients. Should use a different index here. Where the d alphas inside X are codimension 1 subvarieties. We use the term subvariety to indicate that the space in question might not be a submanifold, but codimension 1 still means essentially defined by one equation, one local equation. And any embedding into projective space will determine a family of divisors. Those divisors are all related by this property that di minus dj was the divisor of a meromorphic function. And in general, we'll say that if d minus d prime is the divisor of a meromorphic function, then d is said to be linearly equivalent to d prime. Yeah.
So far, you're just treating X as a general complex submanifold.
That's correct.
You're not restricting to algebraic. I mean, you haven't used the fact that it's sort of specified by some algebraic equation.
That's right. So there's something called Chow's theorem, which tells me that if I have a compact, complex submanifold of projective space, it can be specified by algebraic equations. I should have told you that so that you wouldn't have worried about whether I was being more general than that. But yeah, that everything will be specified by a finite number of algebraic equations eventually. The number of equations may exceed the codimension of the space. So you might need more equations than you naively think you need from a dimension count. But you can describe these subvarieties always by a finite number of equations.
The zero set of X,
of the set of equations, that's right. Yeah, yeah. It's hard not to slip into the technical language with words like variety. Yeah, so because they're not always manifolds, we use this term variety to indicate the zero set of the set of equations. But if it were a manifold and I had put it into projective space, then we would find that differing hyperplane sections, differing intersections with homogeneous coordinates, such as my d sub i's, had the property that the divisor formed by their difference was equal to the divisor of a meromorphic function. So I want to reverse that now, and I want to think of pairs of divisors which are do have that property of being of differing by the divisor of a meromorphic function as forming distinguished subsets of the divisors. It's an equivalence relation known as linear equivalence. So if I'm given d prime, I can consider the set of all d's such that d prime is equivalent to d. So d prime minus d is the divisor of a meromorphic function. And that's called a linear system containing d prime. For compact subvarieties, these linear systems are finite dimensional. So what we want to do is get back to the projective space by considering all these things which look like they ought to be hyperplane sections for the same projective embedding. And we'll do it by looking at these meromorphic functions. So another thing that we can, another way of describing what's happening is we can look at this space, which is sometimes called L of D prime, which will be the set of all meromorphic functions whose pole is D prime. So those are going to be the guys whose divisor looks like D minus D prime for various D's in this linear system. So one should really say whose pole is at worst D prime. And try to use those now as ratios of meromorphic functions. Well, you can see how I'm supposed to use the collection of ratios of homogeneous coordinates over here to get back to recover my embedding into projective space. This again is a finite dimensional space, so I'll pick a basis F1 up to Fn of L of D prime, and I'll attempt to define a map that takes little z to the point 1 F1 of little z up to Fn of little z in complex projective space. So the reason I said this is only an attempt to make such a definition is that this is well-defined away from the poles, so it's well-defined only on x minus d prime. And only gives a partial definition of the map. Well, it's clear how to extend the definition somewhat. What I'd like to do is rewrite that point in complex projective space using one of the other coordinate charts. So, for example, I might rewrite it in this way. So that represents the same point in complex projective space. But now that will fail to be defined at the zeros of F1 rather than at the poles of the functions that I started out with. So I can make other kind of coordinate patches for a map which are given by taking various divisors D in this linear system, looking at the functions whose poles lie on D, so taking a basis G1 up to Gn for those, and then, I haven't set up the notation terribly well, but if I take some D's which correspond to the basis that I chose a few minutes ago, algebraic geometers tend not to choose a basis at this point, but I thought that would make things more clear. I can find a setup so that the point that would be represented by these G's is the same point that I had before represented by the S, wherever both are defined. So this is on the overlap, so on X minus D prime. Well, with a slightly better attention paid to notation, you can see that this will enable you to define a collection of partially defined maps which agree on the overlaps and which should, in under favorable circumstances, add up to a map from X to projective space itself. So I have a partially defined map which at the moment this is defined on the set of, on X minus the common intersection of divisors in the linear system that I started out with. So I've kind of inverted my process, and I've shown that a projective embedding, a map to projective space, corresponds to a linear system with the property that the intersection of the divisors in the linear system is empty. So the key thing to study to try to look at these varieties abstractly is to study all of the possible maps to projective space, and in particular all of the possible embeddings into projective space. That can be studied intrinsically on the variety, or even extrinsically with respect to a given embedding into projective space. In other words, what I should be looking for, if I have X stuck inside of one PN, is all the possible divisors and all the possible linear systems that they form that live on X, even though those divisors, for the most part, will not be associated to the map from X to that projective space. And then I can get properties of maps to all other projective spaces by studying these divisors and linear systems slightly abstractly. Well, in continuing along this program, there are a couple of issues we have to deal with. The first issue that we'll have to deal with is what if the intersection of the divisors in a particular linear system is not empty? The second issue that we'll have to deal with is what if the intersection is empty, but the map, associated map, is not one-to-one. But setting those aside for just a moment, in the case that the map is well-defined and one-to-one, we will get a whole slew of different maps into different projective spaces, and they will each be associated to an appropriate linear system. So maybe to just have some notation, this one might be called phi sub linear system E, and this one phi sub linear system B. And we can study all of those maps intrinsically, and we can in fact get metrics out of these constructions, so-called Hodge metrics on algebraic varieties, which come from pulling back the homogeneous metric known as the Fabini-Studi metric from the complex projective space. So what do I mean by that? Well, in terms of my homogeneous coordinates, I can take dd bar log of the sum of the zi norm squared. That makes sense because if you scale this, you multiply this expression by some constant, and then the log, when you take dd bar log, the constant goes away. So this defines gives a well-defined Kähler metric. In fact, that's the Kähler form of a metric on complex projective space, and I can always pull back or restrict to the image to produce a metric on X. That's a special class of metrics known as Hodge metrics. But another nice feature of the Calabi-Yau setup that I mentioned is that for Calabi-Yau manifolds of the SUN type, at least, the rays spanned by Hodge metrics or Hodge classes in the set of Kähler classes are dense in the set of all Kähler classes. I should have said that the set of all Kähler classes, these were that's a closed two form, and the set of Kähler classes that I'm imagining sits in the second real Durham cohomology. Oh, there's some I here, of course, plus or minus, with the over 2, I'm sure. There's some The set of Cayley classes I regard as describing a subset of the Durand cohomology. When I specified the Cayley class, Gauss theorem told me that there was a unique Ricci flat metric in that class, so that's why I wanted to consider such classes. And they form a cone. If you add together two Cayley classes, you get another Cayley class. If you scale one by a positive scalar, you get another Cayley class. So there's some cone. It might have a complicated boundary. I don't want to imply that it's a round cone. But there's some convex cone, which describes a set of all Cayley classes. And the rays spanned by these Hodge classes are dense. So not only does this study of divisors in linear systems provide a kind of way of getting away from the extrinsic geometry and thinking about intrinsic properties of this space X, but it also provides, in the Calabi-Yau case, a sufficient set of metrics that you can, by just taking linear combinations with real coefficients, describe all the possible Cayley classes. For hyper-Cayley manifolds, the story is not quite as simple as that. There are additional metrics that can't be directly described in terms of Hodge metrics and that have to be approached in a different way. Okay, so just some terminology. This linear system D is said to be very ample if the corresponding map, P sub D, is an embedding. And in general, if you're given a linear system, it's difficult to tell whether or not it's very ample. There are numerical criteria for being ample. So D is said to be ample if some multiple is very ample. And that's a little easier to get your hands on. In general, if you want to describe the set of possible ample divisors on a given Calabi-Yau manifold or given algebraic space in general, algebraic variety. Yes. Sure.
So when you say rays span by Hodge graph, do you mean that you consider all possible D's?
I consider all D's which are giving embeddings, so all of the very ample D's, and I get a Hodge class for each one, and then I take the ray span by that class, and that gives me a dense set inside of here.
And when the D is ample, are those the programs that you mentioned not there?
Very ample means that the problems aren't there. Ample, actually, it can be ample and have those problems. So that's one of the things that makes it tricky to tell whether you have an embedding. I can never quite remember the difference between embedding and immersion. Yes, I know. I really want it not to intersect itself. Yes, so I think that's embedding. Yeah. If it intersects itself, then I agree. From the point of view of describing it metrically, there's no real difficulty. If it's just intersecting itself, if that's the only singularity it has. So you could restrict the metric in that case and get a decent thing. Yeah. So one thing which could happen is that the intersection of all the divisors in the linear system might not be empty. That leads to the very pretty story of what's known as birational geometry. And I don't have time in these lectures to tell you too much about birational geometry, but let me give you an example and then explain some of the salient features of the example. So the example is the partially defined map from P2 to P2, which takes homogeneous coordinates z0, z1, z2, over to homogeneous coordinates 1 over z0, 1 over z1, 1 over z2. So it's a pretty natural thing to think of doing. It's a sensible map because when I scale these by lambda, these guys scale by lambda inverse, but that's okay. It doesn't matter what the scale factor was I used. It's still the same scale factor on all three homogeneous coordinates in the target P2. So this I might call W0, W1, W2, just to be clear on things. And it cannot be made well-defined. Your sort of best hope to try to do so is to sort of multiply everything through by Z0, Z1, Z2 to make a slightly more complicated-looking form. Z1, Z2, Z0, Z2, Z0, Z1. And what you can see here is that if you want all three of these to not vanish, you have to avoid the places where pairs of the Z's vanish. So if both Z0 and Z1 vanish, everything here vanishes. If both Z0 and Z2 vanish, everything vanishes. And if both Z1 and Z2 vanish, everything vanishes. So this is not defined at the three coordinate vertices. What we could do with this, however, is look at its graph, the graph of the points where it is defined. So I'll look inside of P2 cross P2 at the set of all, well, it'll be the set of all Z's and W's, such that as points in projective space, Z0, Z1, Z, sorry, did that wrong, 1 over Z0, 1 over Z1, 1 over Z2, should be the same as W0, W1, W2. And it's not too hard to work out what sort of equations have to be satisfied here. Ratios have to agree, and when you analyze it a little bit, you discover that the only equations you really have to satisfy here are that W0, Z0, W1, Z1, and W2, Z2 are all equal. So that's two equations in this four-dimensional space giving us a two-dimensional graph, as we would expect. What property does this graph have? Well, of course, I wrote down all the equations satisfied by the graph, and now I can look at the solution set of all those equations, and that will include additional points because now I can allow two of these things to be zero without causing a tremendous amount of trouble. I can allow Z0, Z1, and W2 to be zero, for example, satisfying all these equations without causing the problems for the map that I had before. So I'm really taking the closure of the graph and it has for each of my original three bad points, Z0 equals Z1 equals 0, Z0 equals Z2 equals 0, and Z1 equals Z2 equals 0. In the closure of the graph, there's an entire curve which actually represents a line down in the other P2. So this one, for example, is Z1 equals Z2 equals 0, and also W0 equals 0. So with respect to the second P2, it's a line. And similarly here, this one became W2 equals 0, and this guy is W1 equals 0. And then, of course, these are joined by the things which were lines in the original P2. So that's Z1 equals 0. This one over here looks like Z2 equals 0. And this one down here looks like Z0 equals 0. So I get some nice picture with a hexagon of curves. And three of those curves get identified the points when I map to the source P2 from my original map, and the other three curves get identified the points if I map to the target P2 from my original map. So in this hexagon, well, if I had color chalk, in this hexagon there are two kinds of curves, and when I map in this direction, I end up keeping these curves, and when I map in this direction, project in the second direction, I end up keeping these dotted curves. So such a mapping from the original P2 to the final P2 is known as a birational transformation. It has the property that all of the meromorphic functions are preserved. All the global meromorphic functions are preserved. And actually, that can be taken as a definition. So why was that happening here? Well, here all I did was I replaced coordinates with their reciprocals. So when I have meromorphic expressions, rational expressions in these variables, writing them in terms of the reciprocals leaves me with, again, a rational expression. So there's no change in the set of meromorphic functions. On the other hand, as you can see, the theory of divisors was very closely related to what the set of meromorphic functions were. If we tried to stratify the meromorphic functions by what their polar locus was, that led us to these spaces, script L of D, which were the things that we used in describing linear equivalence and embeddings into various projective spaces. So it's natural that the theory of linear systems and so on has an interesting mapping between one of these spaces and the other space. Something non-trivial does happen because poles can change, the locations of poles can change when you go from one place to another, but there's a definite mapping from one place to another here. And for that reason, birational geometry is very closely tied up with this study of linear systems that I've been mentioning here. In particular, the thing that you ought to plan to do if you find a linear system whose intersection of whose divisors is not empty is you should try to find some space like this, which is analogous to the closure of a graph. It's called a blow-up of the original space. And you'd like to try to blow up X to make the map well-defined. And the naive way to do that is to take the mapping, which is partially defined from X to projective space, and just make a graph of it. So you take the graph of phi d inside of X cross the projective space, and you take its closure. The difficulty is that this may be singular rather than smooth, and you have to, if you want to do blowing up in the sense that geometers usually mean blowing up, you'd like to start with a smooth space and preserve smoothness if you're initially starting with it. So you have to work fairly hard to see that you can actually resolve maps by means of operations that do not destroy smoothness. But at least in this sense of taking the closure of the graph, there's always this way to resolve a map, and it's kind of the beginning point for birational geometry. Well, when a map is not one-to-one, several things may be happening. You might have maps which are if phi d is well-defined but not one-to-one, case A is it's generically one-to-one. And this, again, is the context of birational geometry. So an example would be my hexagon space mapping down to one side or the other, in which three of these curves were contracted to points. So the map is not one-to-one. Something strange is happening to it. But away from some sub-variety, some specified subset, the map actually is one-to-one. Or other things may happen, or worse behavior. And in the case of worse behavior, what you will expect to find if you try to study, for example, the behavior of the Fubini-Studi metric associated to that map is that the metric is very badly degenerate. Here you might have a small degeneracy of a metric on some subvariety, which perhaps for some purposes might not bother you too much. But if the map is many to one or actually even collapsing whole subvarieties down to points generically, then from the point of view of studying metrics, it's not something that we want to consider too much. It's an interesting thing to look at in algebraic geometry, but for the purposes of these applications, we don't really need to look at them too much. So the last thing I wanted to do today was give you the translation into algebraic geometry, well, give you a way to attack the issue of whether the translation into algebraic geometry of this condition, kx equals zero, or the existence of a holomorphic n form, give you a way to determine when that's satisfied. So most algebraic varieties do not have nowhere vanishing holomorphic n forms. And what I want to describe is a situation where I have a codimension 1 submanifold, D sitting on in X, and I want to compare the canonical bundle of X with the canonical bundle of D. So this is something called the adjunction formula. Well, and you'll see, well, anyway, let me just tell you what the formula is. So let's suppose that D is locally defined by a single equation. And that we have some meromorphic let me call it alpha, some meromorphic n form on X. So what does it mean to be a meromorphic n form? Well, if I use my embedding into projective space and local complex coordinates somehow, I'll be able to write I'll be able to write alpha as a meromorphic form, which I'm thinking of as a ratio of two holomorphic functions, which is a ratio of two holomorphic functions, times the standard differential dz1 up to dzn. This is where, say, the first n coordinates are serving as good local coordinates on X. If alpha has a simple pole along D, then I can choose this expression so that this h of z1 up to zn is really just f of z1 up to zn. Well, there might be other stuff there too, but anything else would have to be non-vanishing near D, and so near D at least I could incorporate that into the numerator of my expression. So the adjunction formula is based on something known as the Poincaré residue of alpha. Poincaré residue of alpha is the expression that I get by replacing G over F by G over the partial of F with respect to the last variable and leaving out the dzn. And there's a sign, well, I'll take positive sign for the dzn point. So this is a sensible thing to do away from any zeros of the partial of F with respect to n. If I have a non-singular submanifold, D, then at least one of the partial derivatives will be non-zero near any point. So if I make corresponding, and this was restricted to D, excuse me, if I make corresponding formulas for the other variables, which will require signs in order to get the dz over to the, being the last one, I'll get equivalent expressions when restricted to D. The difference between any two such expressions is exact. I'll get equivalent expressions for meromorphic forms on D. And so that leads to this thing called the adjunction formula. When I have a meromorphic form analogous to what I had with a meromorphic function, I'll define the divisor of the meromorphic form to be the zeros of alpha minus the poles of alpha, which really means, in this case, the zeros of G locally minus the zeros of H in my original expression for alpha. And the equivalence class containing these divisors of meromorphic functions is called the canonical canonical linear system on the space X. So what I've just discovered is that there is a representative for this equivalence class, which looks like the divisor of G minus the divisor of F, which is well, somehow I've set up my notation slightly differently today than in my notes. Divisor of G minus divisor of F, which looks like, which the divisor of F was D. D was locally defined by F. And what we're supposed to conclude from this, when you restrict to D, is that Kx restricted to D looks like the divisor of G restricted to D. That's the divisor of a meromorphic form that we're producing on the manifold D minus D restricted to D, which is the normal bundle. So the eventual formula tells me what the canonical bundle of D is. It's Kx restricted to D plus D restricted to D. And that's the thing known as the adjunction formula. Sorry, I kind of made a hash of that explanation. What this is useful for example, is determining which hypersurfaces in projective space could themselves be candidates to be Calabi-Yau manifolds. It's pretty easy to calculate the canonical bundle of projective space by writing down an explicit meromorphic form. That's minus n plus 1 times the hyperplane class, which is the set where any of the homogeneous coordinates is equal to 0, thing called the hyperplane class. And so this determines the possible hypersurfaces which could have k equals 0 as only being those of degree n plus 1. So that's inside P3, a surface of degree 4, inside P4, a threefold of degree 5, and so on. More generally, you might iterate the use of the adjunction formula and try to determine which spaces that you could write directly as intersections of hypersurfaces, one at a time, each one being defined by a single equation in the previous one, which of those could give Calabi-Yau manifolds. And there's a pretty short list for any given dimension. I mean, the list grows with a dimension, but the any given dimension, there's only a finite list of possibilities. However, as I mentioned in response to a question earlier, the general submanifold of complex projective space will require more equations than its codimension in order to fully define it. And this formula stops working as a way of nailing down the canonical bundle whenever we get into that situation where we've required more equations than the dimension. At some point, you'll put in an equation, and that next step, there will be two components to the solution, and you'll need a further equation which doesn't reduce the dimension any further to pick out which of the components that you want. So exploring the set of all Calabi-Yau manifolds is actually much more complicated than that, but this does give us a hint as to where to look for some of them, and I will carry that out and talk about some of the simple examples and what we can say about them in the next lecture.